in Colossians, the third chapter, down at the 18th and 19th verses, are two little concise verses that start off just the way we men like to hear a verse start off. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands, as it is fit in the Lord. Now this is enough. I don't need to read any more. We've talked about the wives. But if we turn it around, it says, husbands, love your wives, and be not bitter against them. Now we've got both sides of the picture. Husbands oftentimes turn to these verses. There are several of them in the Bible that tell the wives to be submissive. But there are also verses that tell the husband that he has something to do. I just wanted to give you a verse of Scripture in case I might forget ever to open my Bible again before the sermon is finished. And now we've had our Scripture, now we can move into the practical things of life. It isn't well to mix religion and work and living and so on. We just go to church for religion. Well, here in our world where we're thinking and as we're trying to expand our concept and our horizon, we might have to take our Bible along and notice how wonderfully it applies to the everyday living habits. I've been talking to you for quite a while about personality development, what causes a person to feel a bit of selfhood, a little bit of person, self-concept, identity. We've thrown around a lot of these words, and I notice several of you are picking them up, and I'm very glad. It impresses me that you're getting someplace, and I'm glad about that too, as you're using my vocabulary. That always helps the speaker to see his vocabulary being picked up. Then I know you're thinking right. And I'm glad about that. But we want to do more than just intellectualize this material. I hope that you can study it. I've given it with the full intention that you might make good use of it in your own life. I haven't just tossed it out here to sort of know you or be impressive. I've felt led of the Lord to present what I have so that you would have a frame of reference on which you could climb out of most any problem. And if you can apply the material, and I realize there are gaps in it because it has to be applied, and we don't have time to go into every detail, of course. But if you can apply the material, you'll find that there is an answer to a large percentage of ordinary problems in life, because there's an interpretation of feelings, an interpretation of moods, an interpretation of what you're seeing happening all the time. And now I'd like to share a little bit about what causes marriages to become a difficult experience. What causes marriages to have problems? And it's related to the very material I've been talking to you about. Because marriages are made up of two people who have personalities. And each personality has its distortions. And it's a very interesting thing, as I've studied marriages for some years, to notice that marriages have a problem that in their personality problems sort of fit together. If you'll notice this little program, it has a fold in it. For instance, it's made out of a piece of paper with two sides. If you look at this side, there's a bulge, and this side there's a dent, you say a groove. But one side of the paper fits the other side of the paper. And that's about the way it happens in marriage problems. If one is control-oriented, the other is more submissive. It couldn't very well both be control-oriented, you see. If one is presenting the strong side and emphasizing the great things of life, the other's allowed to be rather negative and timid and withdrawn. This just fits all the time this way. If a person, one thinks well of himself, the other may think poorly of himself. If one is more hostile and aggressive and showing hostility, the other partner is likely to be more guilt-oriented and blaming himself a great deal. It's interesting how these two sides of the marriage fit together. If they don't fit very well, they usually don't last very long in their relationship, and they find some good reason for getting it legally divided. But I'd like to suggest, as I started off, that marriage, for any couple can improve. Marriage for any couple can improve. And I don't care how old you are, or how young you are, or how long you've been living together, you can improve. There is something you can do to move up a little bit and to grow in brilliance, in the feeling of fulfillment, of real, genuine fulfillment. If you say to me, "Mr. Wagner, you're wrong. There's not one thing in our marriage that could improve. There's not one bit that could be improved upon. We have the most glorious marriage that anybody ever had." I'll believe you, but you've already said something about yourself. You've said, "We are not growing. Neither of us are growing. We're coming to a stagnant place in life where we're not willing to change. We found the utopia, we're absolutely satisfied, and we're not changing." Because a man and a woman living together normally are changing all of the time, because they're constantly growing. They're constantly developing. They're not static. They're not staying in one position. We're always expanding. We're learning a little bit more. We should be. We're growing a little bit here, a little bit there. I believe that if we stop to grow, the Lord has a very good right to take us home. Eliminate us. What good are we? We can't stay static, because we're going to start decaying and regressing. We're made to grow. We're made to develop. Some of us get rather compulsive about this, I'll admit. But on the other hand, I feel that if we don't use our youth, we'll soon lose it. If we don't use our youth, we'll soon lose it. And I don't want to lose anything if I can help it in life. I want to enjoy it as long as the Lord lets me live here. And I've observed one thing in terms of growth about people, that people who have good minds and very happy, pleasant personalities are at an older age, are people who have been fairly well disciplined, have taken good care of themselves, and have kept themselves active, have kept on the growing edge all the time, kept a growing edge in their life. They have not left themselves ossify, to stagnate, to vegetate, to be contented with status quo. They've always tried to move up a little bit and move up a little bit. However, on the other hand, I've noticed that people who start to deteriorate early in life and start showing signs of senility early in life are often people who haven't used their minds much. They're people who have just sort of been content with drifting along. Now, whether it was their fault or not, I'm not here to say. Maybe there were glandular problems, maybe something that we hadn't noticed. But nevertheless, I want to keep active if the Lord will allow me to. And that's my ambition. And I want to keep a growing edge in my life all the time. And if I'm going to keep a growing edge, expect my wife to, too. And as we grow together, we're always going to have a larger area in which we can have fulfillment in relating to each other. Now, I've mentioned four stages of maturation, four ways in which we relate to each other. Each stage of maturation has a certain type of relationship involved. The dependency relationship is the first. Which is parallel to the nursing position of the child. The control relationship is the second, which is parallel to the mastery of the child, where everything has to be under his control, like as if he owns everything. It's domination, pure and simple. Then the third position is the position of sharing, where the child grows into a relationship with others, like he does when he abides by the rules in playing a game. He controls his mastery. He considers the other person as having value. He allows the other person to exercise mastery. It's a sharing, exchange type of relationship. And then there is the fourth relationship, which is a giving relationship or an expendable love, and a relationship in which the person is ready to serve. It's a serving relationship, giving himself to others. In these four stages or four levels of relationship, we of course have idealized the number four position. And I realize, as I have told you about these four stages, that I have given you an excellent little diagram in which you can analyze all your friends and everybody, and you have wondered about many things as to how to interpret this in terms of God blessing you or not blessing you, and can you be in stage two and still be a Christian and all this kind of thing, especially since I said that a child usually moves up to stage three before he's old enough to accept Christ. May I put your mind a little bit at ease to say that normally all people, children, grow into stage three. And the reason that we find adults in a stage two type of thing, where they have to control everybody, is because some circumstances in their youth didn't allow them to stay in stage three. They had to go back to two to try to maintain a living, one and two. And they maintain the one and two most of the time because they cannot get up to the sharing position in life. They can't maintain it. They only maintain it on certain occasions, in certain situations. And it's very limited. And this does not mean that they could not have accepted Christ as Savior and so forth if they're a domineering person. I always stand amazed at how God can reach a person and save his soul. I have seen some people who are actually derelicts as far as Christianity is concerned, with habits that you would think the angel Gabriel would hide his head. Moral habits and other habits that just shock you, and yet they seem to be actually born-again Christians. And I have no way to say that they're not, for after a little counseling to understand themselves, they find the ability to throw off these habits, and they constantly, all the way through, relate to the Lord in some dimension, and the Lord expands that dimension, and they grow in grace and become strong Christians. Now, they say they were saved. They often refer to a born-again experience, but when I get a hold of them to counsel them, I am amazed, honestly amazed, at the condition of their life. And yet I really shouldn't be, I guess, when the Lord himself gave us the parable of the prodigal son and such stories as this, who tell us about a fellow who never ceased to be the son of his father, and yet he got into a lot of trouble. I am always happy to rejoice in the grace of God that he can take anybody in any position of life and make something out of him if that person will give God a chance. Well, just seek the Lord while he may be found, and the Lord will turn to him and gratify his need in a real way. Now, I want to get on into the basic material I have to share with you concerning brightening up the marriage relationship. Moving up to a higher plane of fulfillment is what I'm actually talking about. I hope you didn't get the implication from the title that I thought your marriage was already getting dull. I hope that somebody didn't take that as the implication in the title of the message. Because what we really mean is to move up into a greater level of fulfillment in your marriage. Marriage relationship is basically, for real fulfillment, is basically, or should be, living at least in level three, and best if living in level four. In other words, it should be a sharing, an exchange relationship, but much better if it's a total expendable love that's given between husband and wife, a love that comes with a serving motive, where each loves the other like this. I love you for you. I love you for your gratification. I live to please you. This attitude is the best, of course. And it gives far more fulfillment than I love you so that you will love me, or I love you because you love me. I'm just returning your love, in other words, or I'm loving you in order to inspire your love. Far better to love totally for the other's gratification if you're grown to that place where you can. So we're talking actually about the more mature forms of love. As I said in another message, marriage is for adults who are ready for a mature relationship. Now, there are four qualities that demonstrate this kind of love that makes marriage happy. There are four ways, in other words, to brighten up the marriage. Four factors that you need to pay attention to. I know I'm giving you three or four different key words here. I hope you can pick one of them that sounds good to you. Maybe you might take factors that make the marriage much more fulfilling to increase your pleasure in your marriage. One of the factors, the very first factor I'd like to talk to you about, is understanding. Understanding. Understanding between couples, believe it or not, is hard to find. When a man really understands his wife and a wife really understands her husband, I find more misunderstanding between fairly well-adjusted couples that they just sort of live with. It's like they're living with a low-grade infection all the time. It might break out into some sort of a fever most any time, but it's just living with a poor grade of understanding. There's enough misunderstanding all the time. It's just like a low-grade infection. What do I mean? One of the hindrances to understanding is when one person says, "I understand just what you mean. You mean this. I know just how you feel." And they're meaning to say, "You feel the way I want you to feel. I know how you feel about me." Or the silent type of understanding. "Well, why talk about it? I understand." You'd think it took too much time to communicate. It's a long, tedious process to talk. And so we just cut it off and walk out the door. "I understand. Don't bother. I understand." Children resent this so much when parents say, "I understand how you feel." You resent it too when somebody does that to you. Even though you know they understand, you want the joy of telling them how you feel about it. There's always the possibility that you might contribute a little bit to their understanding too. Now, why would a person say, "I understand"? Don't bother me with the facts, my mind is made up, you know? Don't bother me with the facts, my mind is made up. "I understand." It's because, just as I just got through saying, I don't want to face the possibility that I will have to change some. If I get too much understanding, I might understand that I have a part in this thing. It isn't all your fault. Or if I understand too much, it'll mean something to me. Now, the other party, of course, takes this immediately as rejection. It isn't rejection. Sounds like rejection, doesn't it? "Yeah, I understand. Goodbye. Don't bother me. Goodbye." It sounds like rejection. It looks like rejection. I'm not so sure that it's meant for rejection. It's simply meant, I want to protect myself. I love you, but I don't want to show it right now. I love you, you see, but I'm afraid that of embarrassment. I'm afraid that I might not agree, and I don't want to get involved. There's something about it that seems sticky to me, and I want to get away from it. I don't want to invest myself in the situation. In a sense, it is rejection. But often the motive is misunderstood too. Instead of seeing it as I want to protect myself, the other party in the marriage will take it, I don't like you. And that isn't what it meant. You see? I don't like you. I don't want you to talk to me. I don't like you. No, I want to protect myself from embarrassment, is what the person is often saying. Whenever, I'd like to give you sort of a blanket rule, when you don't understand people and you're having difficulty with them, it doesn't always bring understanding, but it most always helps. Try to be objective in understanding their motive. Ask a few questions about motive. What do you mean? What are you thinking? Why did you say that? Try to get an idea of what was going on. If you can get the other person to even talk that much, it's fine. Wait, John, don't run out the door. Why don't you want to talk to me? Am I a threat to you? Is there something threatening about this? Or, no, I've got to get to work. I haven't time now. But will you talk to me later? You're just a nagging wife. Well, you see what I mean? He might want to get away, but sometime you got him where he can't get away, and then you can say a thing or two and ask a few questions in patience. Understanding is so important. Now, what do I talk about here? I'm talking about the expression of love between couples that leads to total transparency. Total transparency is the goal for real happiness. If you'll follow the tender feelings of your love, your own love, you know where it'll lead you. It will lead you to want to know what the other person is thinking. Exactly. How he's feeling. Exactly. You'll want to know how you're husband is feeling or how your wife is feeling, what they're thinking, every thought. Love leads right in that direction, so that there is a bit of disappointment when the wife will say, no, I don't want to tell you that. You say, wait a minute, why don't you want to tell me? You trying to keep something from me? Or husband says, well, let's not talk about it. That's enough. We don't say any more. She gets quizzy right now. What are you trying to keep from me? Because love seeks this transparency. It's always focused toward it. Real love. In other words, love wants understanding. And when understanding is compromised, cut short, then fulfillment is sacrificed. If you want to improve your own married happiness, start with understanding. Do you still want that transparency? Do you still want her to tell you everything? Do you still want her to share things? Do you still want him to share? Well, maybe your marriage has deteriorated to the place where you say, yes, I want him to share, but let's take it little doses. I'm afraid he'll tell me something I don't want to hear. Whatever it is, you can build toward transparency if you want to. You can work toward it. But transparency, this complete confidence in each other, this open-heartedness, cost something. You can't expect the other person to be any more transparent than you are. It won't work. If you want this transparency, if you want this open-heartedness, you must be just as open-hearted. You must move just as close as you want the other person to come, or it will not work. But if you really love, you will be willing to give of self and grow into a real transparency. I've already used the illustration of the window pane, where one is on one side of the pane and the other is on the other. And in order to remove the pane between the two people, you keep both sides clean, but each has to wash his own side to get rid of the pane that's between the two. Terrible, Corny, isn't it? Our second factor that we must consider if we're going to brighten up and lift our marriage higher is communication. It's related to understanding, but it's different. Communication. Communication is where marriages usually start showing their breakdown. In our experience in marriage counseling, couples that have trouble don't communicate. As their trouble is resolved, it's resolved by communication. And understanding grows out of the communication. Understanding is somewhat intellectual. Communication is, to a large extent, emotional. Communication is discussing and exchanging feelings. Understanding, to a large extent, is exchanging ideas. If communication is on an intellectual level, it's superficial. Many couples are perfectly happy to settle for this. Seems like it. They wouldn't want to be invited up any higher. They've got about all the fulfillment they can stand. They talk about the neighbors. They talk about the papers and the things that are in the paper. They talk about the TV programs. They talk about the children. They talk about everything but personal material. Their finances even, but nothing about how I feel about things. One of the reasons why we've had such a delightful week together, I think, is because we've been communicating. I've been coming across the desk with feelings. You've been coming back to me with feelings. We've had an exchange of feeling communication. If you stop to recall it, you'll notice how many times I have emphasized, do you get the feel of it? How does this make you feel? It's feeling communication. I feel this way. And this is how you feel about it. Now, it isn't that you have to talk, use the word F-E-E-L all the time, but you discuss emotion in many ways, but it's to be come up with the feelings involved. Feelings is where you live, really live in feeling. We mask our feelings with intellectual pursuits and intellectual talk. And if you watch your communication with people, you talk about a lot of things, but you watch them for their feelings. It's the feelings that ride piggyback on their talk that tell you what they're really saying. For instance, I can use the same word in several different ways and mean quite different, have quite different meanings, all because of feeling. Let's take the word good night. Good night. In print, it looks the same. Good night. In print, it looks the same. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. You name it any number of times, you can get different feeling tones. And every time you get a different feeling tone, you get a different meaning. This is how children learn to communicate with their parents before they learn the language. Because there's a language of feelings. And little kiddies pick up the feeling tones of the parents almost immediately. And by they learn their words that go with these feeling tones. And then they learn how they can use the words to disguise their own feelings so that the parents can't figure out what they're thinking about. Words are meant to convey feeling, not to hold back feeling and disguise feeling. I'm sure of that. Communication. If you want to restore brilliance or lift your brilliance to a brighter brilliance in your marriage, watch the feelings that you talk about. And do a little bit more communication in terms of how you feel about things today than you did yesterday. Every time you talk about something, inject a little of the feeling tone about it. Purposely. Share feelings. Share them. This enriches understanding. It enriches relationship. It expresses love. It can express hate, too. The feelings come through. We're particularly interested in expressing the positive, good feelings. Children are very quick to express feelings. And parents will oftentimes hush them. Don't talk like that. They might hear you, you know. One of the ways I think we hurt people a great deal in terms of feeling has to do with weeping. So frequently we speak to children and we tell them to hush up. They're acting like a big baby. I'm getting sick and tired of hearing you cry. You're just acting like a big baby, now shut up. And we humiliate people for crying. I suppose people, let me start the sentence again. People will frequently apologize for something that they say in my office, but one thing they apologize for more than anything else is for a tear, for crying. I'm so sorry, I have started to blubber up again. I didn't mean to do this, Mr. Wagner. I just didn't mean to do it. I had myself all prepared so I would not cry, and here I just can't stop it. Some people I know real well, I tell them the secret. We buy our Kleenex wholesale, and you can help yourself. And others I know real well, I say, well, go right ahead. I wouldn't feel I had a good session if I didn't see some tears. That isn't exactly what I mean. Feelings are true to you. The reason you didn't want to cry is because you didn't want to show your real self. And somebody back in your past associated feelings with weakness, weeping with weakness. And weeping, in my book, is not a sign of weakness, or my Lord was weak. Jesus wept. And he didn't ask any apologies and say, I'm sorry, but I may be the Son of God, but I can't help it but cry. He didn't say a thing like that at all. He simply wept. And if my Lord can cry, I can cry. And I do. And I hope you do too. It's important, I think, to release tension this way. Or God wouldn't give us a promise, a blessing for weeping. Blessed are they that mourn. Blessed are those that weep. And they'll sow in tears and reap in rejoicing and things of this kind. The Lord would not have put value on weeping if there wasn't value in it. I have found that some people are so pent up inside of themselves, they need to cry. They need to weep. And they can't let go. There's such a block to this because of the humiliation involved. And they get actually a frustration or an emotional type of congestion. This, I might as well say it, happens in a funeral parlor so frequently. I don't know what happens down here in Texas, but where I've been serving as pastor, it seemed to happen in most all funeral parlors. They don't let the person cry. About the time the widow, or the one that's the center of attention in the among the bereaved, comes up to the casket to take a last look, and she begins to crack up and begin to cry, here comes the funeral director and pushes her off to one side. There, everything will be all right. And I don't like that. Not that I want to condone a lot of carrying on. That isn't the idea. But I know if I were weeping over one of my loved ones, I wouldn't want any funeral director pushing me away. That's sacred. That's precious to me. Let me get it out of my system so it doesn't take me 6 months to get it out. It might take me 30 seconds or a minute to get it out there, but it'll take me 6 months at home or longer. Furthermore, it relieves guilt feelings. Many guilt feelings are relieved through tears. Especially in a situation like this. There's a way of showing your grief that proves to you you have grief. Otherwise, you sort of feel guilty, you can't cry. There's a place for tears. And couples sometimes are frozen at this point of showing their true emotions, their deep emotions. They can show hostility emotions, but these tender emotions where compassion and love are involved. And yet they say they're happy. They can live with it. I would encourage you to increase communication. Mature it. Grow in it. And you'll find it ever getting sweeter and your relationship growing more and more precious. If you can just communicate more and understand more, you'll find that the person you married is like going into a wonderful, beautiful treasure chest of precious gems and examining every gem and appreciating its value and going back over and examining again and again and finding that when you take up this gem, there's one under just much more beautiful. Human personality is like that when love is inspiring it. As you explore the wonders of the personality of the person that you married, don't just settle for ordinary kind of marriage, common garden variety, especially if you're a Christian. You can grow in your marriage constantly by communication and understanding, but there are a couple of more points that you ought to put down, because they're also important too. That's patience is another one. Patience. If you have communication and you have understanding, you might have patience. But patience is a virtue of the Christian life that is related to faith. It's related to endurance. But it's related to maturity. If I have patience, I have allowed the person with whom I am patient the right to be himself in every dimension of his life. I have ceased from trying to control that person or feel responsible for controlling that person, or feeling responsible for preserving that person. Patience is being willing to accept the situation as it is and enjoy it. Being willing to accept it and to endure it, in a sense, without resentment. To bear it, I should say. Use the word bear instead of endure. To bear it without resentment, whatever it is. Patience. It's a real mark of love. It's a mark of faith. It's a mark of real maturity to have patience. If you'll notice in your Bibles, in James 1:4, patience is related to trouble and difficulty. In Romans 5, it's also related to trouble and difficulty and experience. Patience. It's kind of a dangerous promise, or a dangerous prayer, to ask God to send you patience. Because about the only way you're going to get it is to have trouble. There's an old story about one person who prayed for patience and got 5 kids. But can you imagine how your marriage would be enhanced if each of you could quit trying to control the other and be able to wait upon the other to do his part in his own way? Wait upon the other to use the initiative that is his to use and his or her right to use, and love them so much that they would want to please you and would be motivated to come and be one with you in your desire. Patience is displayed when we have grown out of stage 2, where we have to master everything and control everything. And real patience is when we've moved up close to stage 4, where we can really give ourselves to the situation. And that's why it's so hard for people to have patience, because it's an act of maturity. And actually, for Christians, patience is a fruit of the Holy Spirit. And if you wish this virtue, and you're willing to suffer with Christ, you will receive it. Because patience is God working in you and through you. Under James 5:22-3, patience is another word for long-suffering. Hanging on, continuing to hang on, and not letting go. Patience. The fourth quality that would enhance a marriage and bring people out of the ordinary garden variety of marriage relationships up into the brilliance of cloud 99 is spirituality. Spirituality. Well, you say, that's obvious. How can I have understanding, communication, and patience without some spirituality? Well, you might try it if I didn't talk to you about it. Spirituality is important. What do we mean by spirituality? Well, spirituality means living in this stage 4 and giving God full sovereignty in your life. It means following the Word of God as the rule book. Means living constantly under His control. Instead of being in control, being able to let go of these controls and simply follow. Allowing the Lord to lead. Allowing the Lord to bless. Bless you as He reaches you through the lives of others. Bless you as He reaches you through His Word. Bless you as He reaches you through prayer. Spirituality. It involves many of our habits of life, such as the literature in our home, the music in our home, the entertainment we see and indulge in. Spirituality is revealed in some of our conversation, the words we choose and how we put things together, the emotions we express, and so on. And children, you know, learn to respect Christianity by the spirituality of their parents, or lack of it. Some children take a position in Christianity because they want to be different from their parents, and their parents are definitely not Christian. Others who have Christian parents, so-called, are definitely decided they're not going to be Christian because they want to be different from their parents, and they don't want the kind of Christianity their parents have. Sometimes husbands are defending against the wife's Christianity, or the wife against the husband. I'm thinking of one husband, for instance, who confided in me in the counseling room about his Christianity. I asked him about if he ever prayed. This isn't a frequent topic of conversation. We don't always have to talk about such matters, but it was important at this time. I said, "Do you ever pray?" And he says, "Not much." What do you mean? Well, he said, I used to pray some, but Mr. Wagner, I don't pray much anymore. I'm sorry to say. You go to church? Yes, he says, I go to church once in a while, but I'll confess to you, he says, I sleep right through. He says, I just can't stay awake. I don't even try. He says, I go because my wife insists on it. And he says, I know I should take more interest and I should go more often. And he starts punishing himself in front of me, but he says, I just can't. I said, you can't? Tell me why. Well, he said, there was a time when I first became a Christian. At least he says, I thought I became a Christian. That I was very interested. It happened that my wife became a Christian before I did, and she got very enthusiastic about things out at the church, and she got me interested, and finally I went to church and I got interested, and then the pastor led me to Christ. And then he said, that was the day my wife really became happy about everything, and she decided that we needed to go to church Sunday morning, Sunday evening, prayer meeting, and that now that we're going to have a Christian home, we ought to have daily devotions. So we had devotions on in the morning, and that was fine with me. It sounded great. We're really going into it whole hog. It was great. But then we had to have devotions in the evening, too. And it was Christian music all the time, and we couldn't do this, and we couldn't do that. And he said, finally, I began to decide I wasn't having any kind of a life at all. Was this really Christianity? And I began to question it. I wanted to kind of catch my breath. I wanted to catch up with myself. Everything was just pouring in on top of me, and I wasn't ready for so many changes. And she said, you can't stay home. That's just what you always do. You just start things and never finish them. And then he said, I found I had her right on my back all the time. Here you are. You said you loved the Lord. Now come on. Let's go to church. And you don't mean it. You don't really mean it. Now, how can I ever trust you? And she just got after him and after him and after him. And he says, now, after 6 or 7 years of this, he says, for me to pray and to read my Bible, he says, I can't. The minute I open my Bible or I pray, he says, I just can see my wife grinning at me. At last, you're getting to see the light. When we speak of spirituality, we're talking about the genuine article, not this conceited, self-righteous kind of stuff. Now, the wife was, unfortunately, not a mature Christian at all, and she was not even emotionally mature, very emotionally immature, or she wouldn't have been so possessive, you see. She would let him be a person, too. But spirituality is not the conceited, self-righteous type of spirituality. It doesn't imply to the children in the home that we're better than our neighbors. We go to church. We don't want you to play with children that don't go to church. Well, it may be well for the children to play with Christian children, but to be so exclusive as to be holier than thou brings into the child's life a problem. As I've talked to several children and young people, who when they come to the critical age where they enter into the teens, at the age where it means everything to them to be accepted by their own age group, and they find that their own age group are not church-going people because they met them all at school. They are church-going people. And anybody who goes to church in Sunday school is a big sissy or something anyhow. They make a decision that it's more important to have friends than it is to have Christianity. It's more important to follow the kids than to follow the folks. There's something wrong here, because the pull at this age for acceptance is very great, tremendously great. And if the parents have not been consistent in their Christian living anyhow, and the children have been rather defending against some of the inconsistencies that happen in the home, well, it isn't much of a problem for them to break from Christianity, except that they certainly hear plenty of it from their parents. What will the folks think of our Christianity? What will they think down at the church if we come to church and you're out playing in the street or something? And it's more concerned about what the folks will think in the community or in the church, perhaps, than what they really need and where the problem really is in the home. Spirituality has to be consistent, and that's where the bite comes. It's hard. But a husband is the head of the house, we say. God has ordained him as a man to be the leader in all areas of the life, especially in the spiritual dimension. He's the head in the love dimension of the home. He's the head in the financial dimension and the various ways of providing and all. He's the head in the love dimension. He's head in the spiritual dimension of the household. And God seemed to set up the church so that he would be the head in the church too, in the sense that most all of the major duties of the church seem to be forwarded to the men. Unfortunately, our churches have slipped into the position of thinking that a church is a place where women go, and that men go, some of them, who can't say no to their wives or something. I don't know. It's too bad for a church when it becomes a majority of women there, only women go, or very few men. It's a healthy church when you have a good balance. I remember going to a church in Long Beach when we first moved to California, and it impressed me very much. Here was a fast-growing, moving church. They were in a new community with many new homes, and about 700 in an evening service. And to my amazement, as I looked the place over, half of the audience was men. I don't believe there were hardly any women there alone. I'm sure there must have been, and that many. But it just seemed like it balanced. And they're all young married couples, because it was young married couples moving into this community. And the church was so successfully serving the community that it was a family church. Families went by groups. I talked to the pastor about it afterwards. Yes, we have an intensive program to interest the whole family in the church. It's a family-going church, a very active and alive church. Christianity is a man's business as well as a woman's business. Men have souls that need to be saved too. And in brightening up our marriage, we men need to assume a spiritual leadership in our homes with our wives. I wish I could take some of you fellows to the counseling room and hear some of the cries of women's hearts who say, "Oh, if my husband would only take the spiritual leadership in the home. Oh, if he would only, I could only share the things of the Lord with my husband. In fact, I have to fight hostility because it seems like my husband rejects me all the time. Every time I want to talk about the Lord, he shuts me up. Or he's too busy or something." Now, there's a problem that she isn't looking at too. And that is, she has time to read. She has time to listen to the radio. She has time to listen to records. She has some time, much more time than her husband, to be spiritually informed about things of Christianity. Husband's out fighting the world, from early morning to night, and he doesn't have much time to devote to the Word and to get grounded in the things of the Lord. And when he comes home to a wife who is all loaded with lovely things of the Lord, he feels so inferior, naturally he wants to shut her up. Because he feels like, where have I been all my life? He feels like he's something, he does no value to himself. He loses his own personal value with her. She didn't mean to push him down and downgrade him, I don't suppose, but perhaps unconsciously she does when she says, John, why don't you read the Bible more? Look, here you are watching that silly TV program when you could be reading the Bible. We could have daily devotions if you didn't have to get that 8 o'clock news or 7 o'clock news or something. And this kind of criticism, while it might be something that needs to be changed, but the way it's put to him, it makes him feel like she's holier than he is, and the tension begins to develop. That's why they should run for understanding, communication, work the problem out, you see. Really understand each other and as soon work this thing out. Because she wouldn't want him to feel spiritually immature. She wants to lean on him as her tower of strength. And I believe that even though a man has a busy day, he will spend time where there is value for him. Most men only work 40 hours or 45 hours a week. Some men can't make their living at that much and have to work 60 or more by having two jobs. But even so, there are a few hours every week that can be devoted, or a few minutes, to the Lord and His Bible, and toward feeling the responsibility of spiritual leadership in the household. If a man has value there, if between him and the Lord he feels value, if between him and his wife he feels value, so that she isn't robbing him of his own spiritual blessing. It's important that we treat our mates with this kind of consideration so that they don't defend against us, so that we can't get to the Word like this man I was telling you about. He couldn't even pray because it would be giving in to his wife, whom he had developed quite a hatred for, as you could easily see. To review our four points, let's aspire to understanding so that folks really feel understood. Let's aspire to communication that is really transparent and full of feeling. Patience that's not labored and put on. And spirituality that's not superficial or conceited. When you want to aspire to a better marriage, a more wonderful relationship in marriage, don't look for another partner. Come back to these four points. You loved her or him once. It was tremendous at one time, and if the honeymoon has sort of faded off and become a memory of the past, it can be revived. If you'll go back over these four points, you'll find you can climb out of most any pit in married life. And you can grow up higher to a dimension of living such as you've not known. Some of you may still think I'm talking in fantasy. You have a right to do so. But I believe if you want to work out a marriage problem, you can. But of course, it takes two to make a marriage, and it takes two to mend a marriage. It takes two to improve a marriage. God bless you, as I hope both of you work on the problem, or work on the improvement. God bless you.